Hi, I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness. Your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to my show tonight. Tonight we have with us Dr. Ralph Halsworth and Dan Cho, and I'll let them tell you a little bit about themselves before we get started, because we have a lot of material to cover. My listeners, you probably don't know this, but I had a heart attack about 2 months ago, in September, and a big one. And I had no idea that I was even at risk. And so while I was in the hospital, I had my husband bring up my computer, my laptop, and said, I don't want to do allopathic medicine. The doctors wanted to do 4-5 stents, bypasses, and get me on the heart transplant list. I just couldn't believe it. And so I looked around, and sure enough, there's people in the world who are doing alternative, successful things, so that you don't have to have a vein ripped out of your leg or have somebody else's heart or valve from a pig put in inside your body. And so I just want you to hear what these people have to say. So welcome, Dr. Halsworth, and welcome, Dan Cho. So we'll start, I guess we got to start somewhere. So Dr. Halsworth, please tell us a little bit about yourself, where people can, if you have in a website or information, where people can find you, and what you do.
Oh, thank you, Eve. Thanks for inviting us. And first of all, I'm a family medicine, board-certified family medicine doctor, physician, and I had the great fortune of meeting Dr. Young Cho and Dr. Ken Kinsey, as well as Dan Cho, our other co-host here, approximately 12 years ago. And there was a lot of questions about cardiovascular disease. Fortunately, I ran nuclear reactors in the Navy, had some fluid mechanics, and once I learned what Dr. Kinsey and what Dr. Young Cho and Dan Cho were presenting to me, it made perfect sense that there's 300 independent cardiac risk factors. They all make your blood thick. And so, to me, that started a passion for me and a pursuit and an additional talent to be able to address my patients from a whole other perspective in prevention of cardiovascular as well as cerebral vascular, or the blood flow to the heart and to the brain.
Okay, and I just want my listeners to know that you also did a lot of work with Dr. Jonathan Wright doing functional medicine, so you don't just go to an office and practice allopathic medicine every day, that you do holistic medicine to try to keep people from having to do drugs or surgeries, and that it's possible. And also I want to just tell everybody that tonight, that even though this is Dr. Halsworth is a physician, that nobody is trying to diagnose you or treat you online. We're simply providing this information to you as just that information. So, Dan, would you mind telling us a little bit about you and where we can find you? And also, Dr. Halsworth had sent me a book, The Origin of Arteriosclerosis, that I guess your father wrote. I don't know if that's still available, but it's a fabulous book. You might want to tell people where they can get that and tell them about your laboratory and the testing that you do.
Sure. So that book is co-authored by a cardiologist and an engineer. The cardiologist is Ken Kinsey, and the engineer is Young Cho, who is my father. And that book is called The Origin of Atherosclerosis. It can be found online at Amazon. I serve as a director of a website and a laboratory, which is Blood Flow Online, and people can find that on the internet at bloodflowonline.com. Really, I've had the privilege to be a student of really brilliant scientists and medical researchers, and I've been able to act as, let's say, a sponge or a hub of a lot of information. And our website is designed to provide the public, both doctors and patients, with information about blood flow, about the importance of healthy blood flow and how it affects every organ and tissue in the body, especially the cardiovascular system.
And tell us a little bit about you. I mean, what is your background? You're not just a woman like me asking questions. You have a background and
sure.
education in a field. What is that, please?
Well, I graduated from Harvard, and I have been in the entrepreneurial world for a little bit more than 12 years. I've been in technology companies and came up working at a company called Rheologix, which was founded by the cardiologist I just mentioned, Dr. Ken Kenzie, who was a brilliant inventor and physician. So I've had the privilege, like I said, to be mentored by some of who I believe are some of the greatest minds in medical research over the years, and that's really has been my training. But I am sort of a business analyst by technically by training, and I've had the privilege to serve and in authoring papers and working together with a fantastic team of scientists.
And you were trained at Harvard, right?
Right.
That's where you're okay. All right. The way we're going to, I've never had two guests on my show at one time, so I don't really quite know how to do this. So what Dr. Hallsworth and I decided today was that we would start with the medical part, and then we would go into the lab testing about the medical part. So I'm just going to ask a question. I'm going to start off directing to you, Dr. Hallsworth. However, Dan, if you have some input, please don't hesitate to do that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing that I want to know, is it possible to predict a heart attack or a stroke?
Is it possible? Well, I think it's certainly more possible, or there's a closer probability of doing that with the technology that Dr. Kinsey and Dr. Cho and Dan have developed with whole blood viscosity. I think what I realize and what I was fortunate, as Dan said, with these great mentors, is that the common denominator between all this pathophysiology or the process of the disease was actually the thickness of blood. So absolutely, we now have clinical trials from independent researchers that, again, validate that the most sensitive marker or biomarker for an event, a cardiovascular or a cerebral vascular event, is whole blood viscosity.
And what exactly is blood viscosity? What does that mean?
Well, blood
for people who
yeah,
have
blood
no
viscosity.
Idea
yeah, did you want to? Yeah, it's simply the thickness of the blood, and we say it's whole blood because blood. Not to get too technical, but water is a Newtonian fluid. In other words, when you put shear to it, it does not change the viscosity. Blood changes. It's very similar to, as we call it, thixotropic. It changes its viscosity under different stresses and strains. And that's what we see inside the circulatory system of the body. So I think that's an important thing, and that's one of the things that is very important, and I think a huge paradigm shift for the diagnosis and the therapeutics of cardiovascular disease is being able to determine the thickness of the blood because it changes, and I think it's responsible for a number of elevated blood pressure, the actual events of having a blood clot. And so that's what I see as being some of the more relevant issues of blood viscosity. It's much more sensitive than cholesterol. It's actually even more sensitive than smoking, obesity, and the other classic cardiovascular risk factors.
So I just want to say one thing so that we don't forget to come back to this at some point during the interview. When we're talking about heart disease, we're also talking about strokes too, because you have papers talking about how cholesterol builds up in particular parts of your body, typically in certain parts, your heart, your brain, and in certain parts. So I want to go back there at some point, but right now I'd like for Dr. Hallsworth for you to please discuss the five primary factors that determine blood viscosity so that we'll understand if there's more than one thing.
Well, yes, that's very correct. There's a number of things that actually contribute it, but we basically break them out into different sections, particularly like, you know, hematocrit, which is the volume of red blood cells. We see that as a factor for determining blood viscosity. If we see patients, you know, I'm an emergency room doctor in a rural area, so many times I see dehydrated patients, patients that do not have sufficient intravascular fluids. They're just dry for whatever reasons, excess diuretics, blood pressure medicines. They just haven't drank water, or they have difficulty getting the water absorbed. That in and of itself can increase the blood viscosity as well. Hematocrit, we have a number of congenital diseases that increase your volume of red blood cells, and that has an inherent risk factor for also increasing the thickness of your blood as well. The other one, we look at red blood cells. If we look at the red blood cell, its ability to deform and turn, you know, to bend to get into the smaller portions of our microcirculation is very important as well. The other one is how red blood cells basically stick to each other. They can aggregate and then clump together. We call that aggregation and sedimentation, respectfully. So that also is another factor. A lot of times in conventional medicine, we talk about anticoagulants and antiplatelet drugs, such as aspirin, Plavix, Pradaxil, a number of these other different drugs, and they're working through their ability to keep the platelets from sticking. But the whole idea of blood viscosity and red blood cells sticking together is a whole new paradigm and opens a huge opportunity for research and prevention and therapeutic aspects. I call them anti-viscogenic agents for the prevention of elevated whole blood viscosity and subsequent pathology, heart attacks, or stroke.
So Dr. Hallsworth mentions these factors like hematocrit and the flexibility, the deformability of the red blood cell, the stickiness, how well the red blood cells stick together. And these factors, as well as the plasma content, how much cholesterol or fibrinogen is in the blood. But what blood viscosity does is it takes a step back and allows all of these cellular and biochemical components to work together to create a profile that tells you how your blood is actually flowing. And, you know, some doctors will say, oh, do I really need to know how thick the blood is? Isn't it enough to know the hematocrit? I've heard that question several times. Isn't it enough to know the percentage of the blood that is made up of blood cells? The answer is no. Hematocrit alone does not tell you how thick or sticky the blood is. It only makes up 40 or 50% of the variability of red blood cells, of blood viscosity. I remember Einstein imagined he was sitting on a photon as he came up with the theory of relativity. Well, what we try to do is we imagine that we're sitting on a red blood cell. You know, and what causes these red blood cells to stick together? What happens if the red blood cell membrane is stiff and hard? You know, how will it deform when it has to go through a capillary that's half as large as it is? How will it change shape if it's stiff? Will that, you know, cause a blockage in the microcirculatory level? What happens if, you know, you have a river full of these hard, sticky red blood cells? What's going to happen to the large arteries near the heart that are getting that full force of the impact of blood as it's punched out of the heart? The arteries of in your head and neck and the coronary arteries in your chest, what's going to happen to those arteries? So we try to imagine that we're on sitting on a red blood cell. And the bottom line is that blood viscosity is the factor that aggregates all of these other components to tell you what's really going on with blood flow.
Okay, I have one more question about the five factors, and then I'm going to want to move to what lab testing is available to us and what that testing can tell us. One thing I wanted to ask was temperature. What role does that play, Dr. Hallsworth or Dan, either one of you?
Well, if I may just quickly answer that question, and this has been very well studied by numerous scientists over decades.
Excuse me, we mean body temperature, not the air temperature.
Right. A 1 degree Celsius increase in temperature, by rule of thumb, so generally, reflects a 2% decrease in blood viscosity. So, you know, blood is sensitive to temperature. How it flows, its thickness and stickiness, will be altered. So there's an inverse relationship between blood viscosity and body temperature.
So I want to understand this. I know that I have low body temperature. So what does that mean to my blood typically? I know my temperature usually runs about 97.6. What would you expect my blood to be? Thick or thin?
Well, thicker. Thicker than it otherwise would be. If you went into a tropical, beach environment, your blood would be expected to be thinner than if you were in Alaska, in the height of winter. So that is a proven scientific fact that there is that relationship that colder temperatures reflect thicker blood.
So one thing I've always noticed in my life and many people that I know that have heart disease is they're always hot. Is that why? Is that one of the reasons? I mean, my husband and I, we always fight over temperature. And I know that I have low heart disease. I know that I have thick blood. I know that. And I know I have low body temperature. But is that why I'm hot all the time?
But Dr. Holdsworth might, I want to weigh in on this. All I would say is that there is a connection, direct physiologic connection between body temperature and blood viscosity being an inverse relationship. But we also know that blood viscosity reflects the level of inflammation in the blood. If there is an inflammatory response due to whatever stimulus, the blood will get thicker. So those are two different things going on that could be affecting, the heat, the how hot.
Oh, that makes so much sense, because inflammation is always hot. You get an infection and on a wound, and it's hot. That makes so much sense. Okay, so excuse me.
I'm sorry. Clinically, though, there's the thyroid. We call the master glands, which you think is basically being the thermostat in the body's body. Typically, women have a higher susceptibility to hyperthyroidism, and so therefore their body temperatures will be running a little bit cooler, and that has a direct effect on blood viscosity. And when I'm doing my clinical exams, my first introduction and handshake allows me to assess what the peripheral circulation is in that person. Is this a elevated blood viscosity where the patient, or is this a lower body temperature that's causing the cool extremities, or is there some other factor attributing to the patient's coolness? So it's multifactorial, but I think to address your specific concerns, that could be secondary to a low thyroid function.
That's such an interesting perspective. Your handshake tells you something about the health before you even get started. Never thought about that. Okay.
Absolutely.
So my next question is, are there tests out there, and what are they, and what do they tell us, and why should we do those tests early today in modern times? There are more people with heart disease. Our children are having heart disease, in elementary and junior high school. So what is there out there that we can see to predict? Dan, I guess that's probably you.
Please, Ralph, you want to start?
No, let me introduce you, Dan. I mean, All I would say is that similar to diabetes, it actually takes approximately 7 years before a clinician can actually diagnose a patient as being diabetic. The diagnosis of an elevated whole blood viscosity gives us an opportunity for an early intervention to, and it is a chronic process. And so I'm greatly beholden to the technology there, the whole blood viscosity, and the development of the Hemofix, which is a diagnostics, and I'll let Dan go from there.
Yeah, our team, we've dedicated, many years and a lot of our energies to developing an instrument that can test for blood viscosity. Blood viscosity is the measurement, that linchpin that tells you how thick and sticky the blood is and how much injury, how much damage it's doing to the arteries. That is the early, more accurate predictor of cardiovascular risk versus a CBC, a measurement of the cellular content in the blood, things like red blood cell, white blood cell counts, as well as chemistry in the blood, which you can move beyond that into a lipid profile. These are the existing tools that have been used, and they're very important, necessary actually, for doctors in assessing the state of their patient's blood. But that doesn't tell you actually how the blood is flowing, how well it can flow, and how much damage that the blood can do to the arteries. So this new test, which is what we're talking about, whole blood viscosity, is the very test that will indicate the thickness and the stickiness of the blood.
Okay. So the next question that I have is, what I read in some of the research or articles that you both of you provided me, that viscous blood is abrasive blood. What does that mean to us, to people?
It really is as simple as that. And when you think about this disease, what is heart disease and cardiovascular disease? It's actually a spectrum of disorders, right? the most common form of heart disease, is atherosclerosis, which is a process which affects the arteries. And you have plaque, atherosclerotic plaque, or these blockages that are occurring in the body, and they happen to occur in some parts of the body and not in others. So once we ask that question, why? Why do people get atherosclerotic plaque blockages in the large arteries that are feeding the heart and brain, that are close to the heart, and also in the arteries of the legs in some diabetics, but never in the arteries of the arms or not in a woman's mammary arteries? That type of simple, almost elementary question really highlights a profound truth, that it's not just the biochemistry, that it's not just your LDL cholesterol, because if it was just LDL cholesterol that was the cause of this disease, then wouldn't you see these blockages more uniformly throughout the body? But no, you only see it in certain parts, which quickly allows us to realize that it's the physics. It's the physics, and it's thick, abrasive blood damages the arteries. It's going to damage the arteries that are closer to the heart, that are feeding the heart and brain, and also in the legs of some diabetics because of the pull of gravity as the blood accelerates down the arteries in their legs. And that shows us that viscous blood is abrasive. It is, true that thick blood damages the arteries and is at the root of this disease when you look at the site and region specificity of plaque.
So how does, like I told you, I had a heart attack a couple of months ago, and my doctors limited me, the allopathic doctors at the hospital where I went, said, okay, you can now only have 60 ounces of fluid a day, including the fluid in your food that you eat. How on earth, and I weigh, I hate to tell you this, I weigh about 170 pounds, I'm 5'6", and according to the body, what is that rest test that we had that I did, Ralph? You know, it tells you how much body fat you have, and so whatever that.
Oh, body mass index.
Yeah.
BMI. Okay.
Yeah. I'm like 1 point on being overweight for my size. So how the heck do I stay hydrated? Because I've noticed since I had this heart attack, my neck kills me. And the tendons, you know, I start getting these massive headaches, tendon headaches, and my legs hurt. How do we stay hydrated? How do you do that?
Well, I think that's, I'm not quite sure the, you know, a lot of times patients with congestive heart failure will put them on a fluid restriction or put them on diuretics, i.e. a water pill, and they're the philosophy, or and what I feel they're doing there is that they're controlling the numbers, i.e. the blood pressures, but the biggest thing that we really need to be doing is treating the blood viscosity. And so many of my patients, you know, I work in an emergency room. I have people with a hypertensive crisis. They're on a lot of diuretics. They're elderly people. What I find so often, if I can give them an intravenous infusion of normal saline, their blood pressures will come back down. And I think simply what I'm doing is addressing the thickness of their blood and allowing the autonomic system to control their blood pressure once I restore the intravascular or the fluid volume that should be appropriate inside their blood vessels.
That was going to be one of my questions, is when someone's autonomic nervous system is out of whack, and I really don't even know what I mean by that, but I know that mine was, because I always felt too much energy, like frenetic energy on the inside, if that makes any sense. And I know I've had some dysautonomia experiences in my life. So what is the relationship between the autonomic nervous system and cardiovascular disease? How do you address it, or can you, or do you need to?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of this we talk can be attributed to what we call a physiological or psychological stress. One of the things that we see is that people are always in a sympathetic mode. We're always fight or flight. You know, there's a great book. I apologize, I forgot the author, but why zebras don't get ulcers. And again, the bottom line was that, you know, once an animal is in fight or flight once it's chased, but other than that, it's peaceful. It's grazing. It's, you know, doing its thing. Whereas modern society and technology, we're always in sympathetic. We're always, you know, in a rat race in flight or flight. And I think you'll see that cardiovascular disease is extremely elevated in industrialized nations, probably in large part to that. But not to simplify that, but again, you know, we'll see patients, quote unquote, stressed out or, you know, adrenal insufficiencies, et cetera, you know, that the body works as a whole together to try to accommodate all these things.
Is there anything else, because I'm going to ask Dr. Hallsworth some other questions then, so is there anything else that we've left out about your testing before I move on to these other test questions I have for him or you?
Yeah, I will say that, you know, our team, we worked very hard in developing this instrument, and we've partnered with a laboratory in Seattle called Meridian Valley Lab, and that is a laboratory that was founded by a gentleman named Jonathan Wright, who's a physician, a colleague of Dr. Ralph Holdsworth. And this laboratory has a national reach. They serve thousands of doctors in almost every state in the country. The doctors send samples, their patient samples, to the laboratory, and the laboratory processes the samples. You know, they were a leader, the very first that introduced bioidentical hormone testing for the United States, and they have been a pioneer in many, many areas. They've really taken hold of blood viscosity as a third pillar of their laboratory, and we are partnered with them. So doctors that want to begin using the blood viscosity test can simply just reach out to to Meridian Valley Lab in Seattle.
And where can they find you, Dan? They have questions. Who do they write? How do they contact you?
I'm reachable at my email address, which is dan@bloodflowonline.com. So it's just like it sounds, bloodflowonline.com. And that website, as I mentioned before, is an informational portal focused specifically on blood flow.
Okay. Now, Dr. Hallsworth, I know that you are doing some work with a woman named Dr. Patricia Kane, and that you are doing some specific protocols that can actually prevent people from having the veins ripped out of their legs or valves, you know, pig valves put in their heart and or a new heart, you know. Can you tell us about what you're doing there? Genetic testing. What are you doing? Phosphatidylcholine. What are you doing with her?
Well, Patricia Kane is a nutritional biochemist. She has a doctorate in that. And what she introduced to me was the fact that phosphatidylcholines, which are lipids, they're good lipids. They actually act like HDL, the good cholesterol in the body. So I have orally and IV administrated this to patients to help get their blood flow better. It also, the red blood cell membrane has many different types of phosphatidylcholine. And some of the research I've studied shows that the phosphatidylcholine, whether you take it orally or given IV, allows that red blood cell to be more deformable, to bend, to be more pliable, so it can access the microcirculatory portions and perfuse of the body. So that's the other thing is a calcium magnesium butyrate, which is real important for gastrointestinal health. It's a short fatty chained acids that actually help with the probiotics, the good biotics, but they also have the incredible ability of eliminating oxidized fats in your body. And as Dan mentioned earlier about the atherogenic and how cholesterol contributes, it's the ones that are oxidized that seem to be the most insidious in the process of plaque formation. So there's a multitude of this, different abilities of these combinations, as well as just restoring the appropriate fatty acid balances in the body because that controls inflammation. And we look at high sensitivity C-reactive protein, which says, is your vascular system on fire? Is it inflamed? Because if it is, it can increase your potential onset of a heart attack or stroke fourfold. In a large part, there's a direct correlation with whole blood viscosity. So an inflamed vascular system carries thick blood, is what I've seen. Whether it's autoimmune, I see it in cancer, I see it in patients that have septic joints or different infectious sites in their body, their blood becomes thick.
So I've kind of made my life an open book to my radio show listeners, and I made a decision when I had that heart attack, and you know, Dr. Hallsworth, it was a pretty bad one. And I've made a decision that I want to go a holistic route, and I'm either going to get well or I'm going to die. And Dr. Hallsworth and Patricia, Dr. Kane, have both encouraged me that I can get well holistically. And so I'd like, if you don't mind, I give you permission to talk about my case and what you've looked at my records, what you've diagnosed me with, and what we plan on doing, and that there's actually hope for people out there that have this problem, that you can do something about it rather than... First thing the doctor said to me, I want to do five stents. In a month, I want to do a bypass surgery, and then I want to put you on the list for a heart transplant. So what was your response to that, Dr. Hallsworth, when I called you?
Well,
do I have hope?
Absolutely. And the way we look at this, you know, I practice metabolic cardiology as well, but what we want to see is it's not always a plumbing problem. I think, you know, interventional cardiologists and thoracic surgeons, cardiologists approach it as a plumbing problem where they can put in a stent or a little opening in there, and that's good, and it does have life-saving measures. But, and I think Dan will agree with me, is that the physics of the blood flow have not changed, and that the problem will only migrate upstream because we haven't addressed. And I am very grateful to all of the previous cardiovascular researchers, Dr. Kinsey, and many other ones that I have studied underneath. But one thing that I think is important is that the starting line begins in the blood flow. They've talked about endothelial dysfunction, and we now know that there's actually inflammation. Thick blood causes the endothelial dysfunction. Now, specifically to your case, one of the things we still have some lab pending is that you had probably a folate deficiency, which affected the shape of your red blood cells, and that was noted in some of your complete blood count. The other underlying thing was that if you have a folate or B6 or B12 deficiency, then there's a likelihood of you having a development of homocysteine, which is an amino acid metabolite. And Dr. McCulley did all this research where he would inject monkeys with homocysteine, and that would precipitate the plaquing. So that's another feature there, as well as, you know, the low thyroid function. We know patients that have a low thyroid, or their thermostat, biological thermostat, is, or master gland, is not functioning optimally, then they have a higher incidence of blood clots, or, you know, an event of a heart attack. So again, there's 300 cardiovascular risk factors, and I think it takes a physician or a group of physicians to look at all those different factors. And I always tell my patients, you have a glass coffee table. I am trying to take the bricks off the glass coffee table. So as we identify those, unfortunately for you, Eva, yours are very preventable and very treatable. So that's why I give you a good prognosis in, you know, curing this particular dilemma and preventing you from having one in the future.
So I want to tell my listeners this, too. I've had 5 family members all on the same side. Well, actually, my parents were third cousins. So it was my mother, my mother's father, my mother's father's mother, my mother's father's mother's sister, my mother's father's mother's sister's daughter, all had the exact same heart attack that I had, except they blew out the back of their ventricle and they died. So I didn't die, and I hope, but my friend Bart Flick up here, the doctor I work with, says, you know, maybe it's all this amino acids and supplements and vitamins that I've been taking to help it. But either way, I have this long history of people dying early, 49 to 56 is when they all died. So I'm wanting to let all of you know that people like Ralph and Patricia Kane and Dan Cho can help you not continue this history in your family for your children, yourself, your children, and your grandchildren. So tell me about, we did a genetic test the other day, Ralph, and I know it's not gotten back yet, but will you tell my listeners about that? And we've got 20 minutes left, so let's talk about that, and then I'd like to leave you and Dan a few minutes to talk about whatever you want to talk about that we've not talked about, which is, I'm sure, a lot.
Well, I mean, as far as the genetics, there's one thing that Dan Cho and I have been looking into the different sizes of cholesterol. They're actually different particles. There's pattern A, pattern B of your low-density lipoproteins, and those are very important, again, for the very reason that Dan mentioned, is that, you know, when your heart pumps or kicks blood out of the left ventricle, it can be very abrasive. So if your cholesterol is big and fluffy, then it's going to kiss the linings of the arteries, whereas if it's small and dense, it's going to abrade. It's going to act like it's sandblasting that endothelial. So we're able to break this down. And fortunately, I believe your pattern was sort of a mixture of both, A and B. But one thing I will mention specifically is little A lipoprotein. It's a congenital type of lipid that confuses the body, and it actually makes it the body very susceptible to having an inadvertent blood clot, i.e. a heart attack. And so that's one thing I encourage all the listeners out there to, you know, push your doctor to, you know, do a VAP, a vertical assessment panel, or a Berkeley cardiac panel. And it's a little bit more, but it is so valuable, and it's so preventable with the use of natokinase and niacin. And again, I had one patient of mine who had a stroke when she was 19. She was on oral birth control pills. And she saw me in the emergency room about 6 months ago. She followed up with me in the clinic. I did a very similar test that I previously mentioned. I noticed that she had Lp(a) lipoprotein. I put her on niacin, and I put her on natokinase. Now, statin drugs do not work for Lp(a) lipoprotein. That's well documented with Dr. Steven Sinatra's book.
Is that the what I have or not?
Well, I did not see that in yours. But I'm just saying, but this patient had remarkable comeback. She actually lost some of her neurological deficit at 47 that she had from a stroke when she was 19. So, and I've seen this time and time again. They call it the widow maker, but I stress, you know, males and females, that this is something that's a little bit, I mean, it's not that uncommon, and most physicians know about it, but a lot of times we just do the standard old cholesterol fasting lipid test, and that will not detect that.
So if somebody is on Coumadin or some other blood thinner, how do you get off and use natokinase or niacin or something, or some combination thereof? How do you get off those drugs? That's one of my biggest things. They have me on that, and I wish you could see me. I look like that I've been an abused spouse or something. All you have to do is touch me. I don't want to be on that drug. How do I get off?
Well, again, we go back, and there's a number of people who have gotten off of it. But what I suggest is that we do an informed consent. And then one of the most important things is that you did have your whole blood viscosity completed. And Dan did that. And we showed that your blood viscosities were in the good ranges there. But what I work with my patients is I try to do testing that we've done for you and just take those, eliminate all those possibilities. In other words, all those different independent risk factors. And then I have to make a decision. And a lot of times I work closely with cardiologists, and if we're able to determine the only reason the patient's on warfarin is because of this one isolated reason, then they feel comfortable with stopping that and just, you know, continuing natokinase or lumbrokinase or some other you know, appropriate thing to make sure that the blood viscosity is decreased. And that's what's nice. We can check this now. And that's what actually led me to a lot of my research with blood viscosity, was because I was treating patients with natokinase. I needed to know, what was the most sensitive marker there for determining where they had a high probability of a heart attack or stroke.
So why would... you might want to say what natokinase is briefly, but why would natokinase not work if you're on a Coumadin or something, why could you not come off and take natokinase?
Well, I think it's quite honestly, we just have not done enough research, and we haven't done a head-to-head trial. And that's really, I can tell you that I have people contact me from all over the world that either have adverse drug reactions to warfarin that have been on natokinase, and for the most part, they do well. But again, you know, we need the scientific research there. And then I think Dan can speak to, you know, about what are the effects of warfarin on blood viscosity.
Well, just one other comment on natokinase. Natokinase is a natural enzyme that's derived from a fermented soy, and it is what we call a fibrinolytic enzyme, meaning that it cleaves the fibrinogen, which is a very important molecule that increases the stickiness of the blood. So natokinase has been shown in studies, and we understand the mechanism that it does make the blood less sticky. When we talk about blood thinners, there is a fair bit of research that has been done. Aspirin, for instance, has been shown not to lower blood viscosity, but Plavix, clopidogrel, which is, you know, another blood thinner, has been shown to reduce blood viscosity by as much as 18%. The stickiness, the diastolic blood viscosity, was reduced by about 18%. So, you know, what we see is that different drugs have different effects on the blood viscosity, and we hope with additional research, some of these natural products can you know be utilized more often for treating hyperviscosity.
I just absolutely cannot imagine why some natural thing cannot be used to fix this, because I'm sorry, but God didn't make us with a shortage of Plavix. You know, honestly, I mean, seriously. So there's got to be diet. We haven't even talked about that, but we now have 10, 12 minutes, so I'm going to let you guys talk about whatever you want to talk about that we, my listeners need to know that we haven't discussed. It's your time.
Well, Dan, I think one of the huge things, and I tell patients this, I said, even people in the grocery store, I said, if you don't believe me, if you don't remember anything I ever say again, remember that donating blood over your lifetime will ensure a significant decrease, and Dan probably has the exact statistics, but anywhere up to 80 to 90% decrease in your lifetime events of a heart attack or a stroke simply by donating blood. And so I've been a big proponent of encouraging my patients. I tell them it's good for humanity and it's good for them. And I've donated every 3 times a year. I do a double unit, and I've done that since 2001. And I think it's singularly one of the most important things, as well as right up there with hydration. And I've done some recent research with just hydrating patients, and we actually use firefighters. But I'll let Dan contribute there to some of the things that he'd like to share with us.
Nah, those are actually the very 2 points that I was going to make. And just to elaborate on each of them, you know, our old friend, the late cardiologist Ken Kensey, used to joke that a bypass surgery is really a $50,000 phlebotomy. And that's a very extreme statement that he would make, you know, to get a shock effect out of people. But what is true, is absolutely true, is that blood donation, regular blood donors have been shown to have about 88% fewer cardiovascular events. We're talking about a myocardial infarction, you know, the classic heart attack in the coronary artery and strokes. And this was a study that was done in Scandinavia where around 3,000, a little less than 3,000 males were followed for years, and they showed that regular blood donors did have, you know, almost 90%, 88% fewer heart attacks. This study was questioned, and there was a great controversy over it, but ultimately, you know, in the follow-up analyses, they showed that this was, in fact, true. Separately, in a completely separate series of studies, blood donation has been shown to lower blood viscosity. So the point I think that we're making is that you can do something charitable by going to the blood bank and giving blood that is also profoundly beneficial to yourself. Removing blood, just taking out a portion of the blood, and not for everyone, but for the vast majority of the people, is helpful. It causes the body to regenerate, to make newer, younger red blood cells. So the red blood cell will live for around 120 days from the time that it's formed in the bone marrow until the time that it's removed by the spleen. And during that 120 days, it gets harder and stiffer, you know, more like a raisin than a nice balloon. And that, you know, stiff, rigid red blood cell that's older is damaging the arteries and also preventing blood flow to the smallest capillaries of the body, right, including the brain, the kidneys, you know, and your hands and toes. Throughout the body, every organ and every tissue depends on life-sustaining perfusion, and that red blood cell needs to be soft and deformable. Older cells are harder and stiffer and more rigid, so by removing a bit of the blood, you cause the body to have younger younger red blood cells, and that has a profound impact on your blood viscosity and your cardiovascular health.
So I have a question. I went to give blood one time at a blood, one of those drive-up things at Walmart, and for the first time in my life, they wouldn't take it because they said I was anemic. So what do you do there? How can you fix being anemic, or how can you get the blood out and dispose of it so you could make them more? What do you do in that situation?
That's a critical dilemma that I have been focusing on for a while now. Even if you travel to England or any country where the American Red Cross deems to be a malaria risk or mad cow disease or what have you, you know, they'll turn you away right there, as well as anemia, or if you're on certain medications, many, many people cannot give. So what we are looking forward to is, you know, a change in the medical community where doctors are doing therapeutic phlebotomy for their patients. And it doesn't have to be, you know, 500 mLs, the full pint for everyone. It could be a lesser amount. And additionally, you know, supplementation by iron or just eating a lot of broccoli or foods that are high in iron could be helpful to someone who's anemic, especially if they only remove, just say, 100 or 200 mLs from the body.
Okay, so I wonder why, I've given blood all my life. I'm 52. I've had a partial hysterectomy, so I don't lose blood. Why would I suddenly become anemic?
Well, there's a number of reasons there, and I think one I earlier mentioned in going over your health history there was the folate issue.
Oh,
you talk about pernicious anemia.
Okay.
Pardon?
Is folate the same as folic acid, or is that different?
Yes. Yeah, well, it's one of the metabolites leading to it, but, you know, the intrinsic factor combining the B12 as well as the folate. Folate is the most common vitamin deficiency in industrialized nations. Even if you eat leafy green salads, you know, foliage, folate, coming from the Latin deviation, derivative of that. So, again, that could be, you know, there's a lot of different causes for, and then it has to do with the size of the red blood cell. Is it microcytic, small one, macrocytic, where it's more B12 folate deficiency? So there's a number of reasons that can attribute to anemia.
So you take, You don't go to Walmart or whatever and buy folic acid. You go somewhere and get folate. Is that correct? Am I understanding?
Well, there's a number of different forms. I mean, the methylfolate is probably the best one, and but again, it's very difficult to absorb it, especially if you have low stomach. I mean, insufficient stomach acid. Not to digress, but a lot of times I have to place my patients on injections, intramuscular injections weekly, and then I know that they're getting the appropriate B12 and the folate that they need for proper red blood cell simulation.
So that's the thing that Jonathan Wright brought up with me that I didn't realize was that as you get, you never see kids with, well, at least you used not to, with reflux. It's always older people, and doctors always give you some kind of antacid when really it's because you don't have enough. Do you have any comment on that? We got 3 minutes.
Well, I mean, Dr. Wright published that data, and he showed that he was able to reverse reactive airway disease in those children by simply giving them B12 shots. And again, he was basically, you know, correcting the underlying problem that those children were predominantly on dairies, requiring too much, that they weren't able to produce enough hydrochloric acid and sustain a low enough pH to assimilate their foods. So they became antigens, triggering their asthma. But that's been well addressed there. How about you, Dan? Any other
comments there? No, nothing to add on that particular.
Well, you've got 2 minutes. You can talk about anything you think we've left out.
Well, we talked about nattokinase, and in terms of things that are regularly available to regular folks, you know, you could walk up to the Whole Foods or the vitamin store and get nattokinase. You know, that is a fibrinolytic enzyme, a viscosity-lowering enzyme that is available to most people. Other things, you know, that just putting this out there are different kinds of functional water. You know, you have hydration, which is an issue, and people are profoundly dehydrated in our society. We eat, you know, so high levels of salt, and most of our you know, processed drinks are acting as diuretics. But having water that it hydrates the body, waters that are, let's say, reduced alkalized water, things like essential water or other similar high hydrating water are helpful for people. But the point is, whether it's just the water out of the tap or you know, some advanced functional water, people do need to stay hydrated by drinking you know, sufficient levels of water.
Well, thank you both for being on my show. Obviously, we didn't, I mean, I know how many papers that I have here on my desk for me in this book, and I know how many conversations that we've had, and there's so much more, so there, we have to do other shows. I hope you guys come back, but thank you so much. If you'll please, forgive me, tell us one more time where to find you, and maybe, Ralph, you may want to say where people can find the work that you're doing with Patricia Kane.
Yeah, I think, I don't have a website per se there, but, TahomaClinic.com, so T-A-H-O-M-A, clinic.com, that will give you a bio of my background. It'll also introduce the whole blood viscosity, and then MeridianValleyLab.com, which there's a link to, will also be another excellent source. Plus, you know, the website that Dan mentioned previously as an independent web source of all the information, scientific literature collected in one, you know, very friendly web platform for all our listeners to go to and read by themselves. I mean, read the research. Don't believe us. Look at the research and the different papers that a lot of other independent researchers have come to the same conclusion, that the common denominator of over 300 cardiovascular risk factors is the whole blood thickness.
And
okay.
That website is bloodflowonline.com, bloodflowonline, just like it sounds.
And what is Patricia's site, the PK protocol?
I think it's pkprotocol.com, and the other one is Body Bio, so BODYBIO.com. Both of those should link you up. Again, she's done tremendous amount of work, neurodegenerative as well as cardiovascular.
Well, thank you both for coming on. I hope you will. Well, I hope you'll arrange very soon to come back again. So I'd like to let people follow us as we do these treatments, so they'll know that they're really working. So good night, and see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.